Hello, my name is Michael Johnston, and this is New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. Today I have Dr. Tanya Jenkins with me to discuss her book, Doctor's Orders, The Making of Status Hierarchies in an Elite Profession, which will be soon published by Columbia University Press and will be available for purchase June 2020. Dr. Jenkins is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in the Department of Sociology.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me on the program.
Excellent. So to get started, could you tell me a little bit about how you got started with this topic for research? It's kind of a little bit unique in terms of what I've explored before and what's out there in terms of publication, because it is in another field completely, medical field, but it's a sociological take on the medical field.
Yeah, so I arrived at this topic, like many researchers do, by total accident, really. I had to take a qualitative research methods course on political ethnography my first year of graduate school, back when I was at Brown University. And I remember this was a required course. I had no choice but to take it. I had always had an interest in qualitative methods, but I didn't consider myself an ethnographer, and most certainly not a political ethnographer. I remember thinking to myself kind of annoyedly, I study medicine, not politics, right? And here I am having to take this course. And I didn't really understand what ethnography was either. I think I had this vague sense, having studied anthropology as a minor in undergrad, that it really involved going to far off lands and becoming one with the natives. And so I wasn't enthusiastic about this course. But of course, I had to complete it. And the professor at the time, you know, in his wisdom, helped me see that, you know, there are politics everywhere. There are hierarchies and power everywhere. And so might there be a social space that I would be interested in observing those power dynamics taking place? And over the winter break prior to that semester, I had read a couple of memoirs written by physicians. And in particular, there was one that stood out to me. It's a memoir called Intern by a physician named Sandeep Jauhar. It's a very honest account of his experience in residency. And one of the things he described in this book is this practice of pimping, which is effectively, in medical circles anyway, putting subordinates on the spot. So putting medical students or residents on the spot in a kind of, sometimes it can be in a humiliating kind of way, and using Socratic techniques to elicit, answers to questions. And so I thought that would be a really interesting power dynamic to observe. And I set out to observe it in the hospital that I could access through a friend of mine, namely Legacy Community Hospital. And so in February of 2011, I started fieldwork for this course at Legacy Community Hospital, studying their internal medicine residency program. And I set out to try and observe and understand hierarchy in medicine through this practice of pimping. And it was as early as my first day in the field, a resident, pulled me aside and said, if you want to study hierarchy and you want to see pimping, you've come to the wrong place. I remember his quote saying something like, where I went to medical school, I never looked my attending in the eye. But here, that's not the case. You're not going to find that kind of power dynamic. So instead, what I actually found was very little in the way of hierarchy. And in fact, very little in the way of formal teaching, which I get at in the book. And I did what any good junior scholar would do when faced with these surprising findings. I promptly freaked out. I started panicking, worried about having to complete this course on political ethnography. I wasn't seeing what I thought I would get, what I was going to see. And it took me a while to sort of take a breath, first of all, but also to take a step back and ask myself, so what is different about Legacy Community Hospital compared to these other hospitals I had read about in books, right? And there were a couple things that stood out once I finally was able to take stock of what was going on. The first thing is that Legacy was a small community hospital, right? So they're, you know, it's a very small hospital, you know, fewer than, you know, several hundred beds. It's in a low socioeconomic status neighborhood, and it also had very few or at least limited medical services on offer. So in that way, it was kind of a small town, right? And in a small town, we don't see the kinds of hierarchies that we might observe in a larger kind of setting. The other thing about Legacy was that it was definitely, by virtue of being a community program, much less prestigious than some of the programs I had read about. It had an affiliation to a medical school. It was a weak affiliation, meaning there really wasn't all that much in the way of contact between the program and this medical school. There was certainly less teaching going on, and less formal teaching than what I had expected to see. And it eventually took me a kind of embarrassingly long time to realize one of the starkest differences between Legacy and some of the hospitals I had read about. And namely, what I realized is that all the residents in the 3-year internal medicine program, the categorical program as it's called, were from either international medical schools or had graduated as doctors of osteopathic medicine, or DOs. The reason that took me so long, as you might have gathered from the introduction, I'm originally from Canada. I wasn't familiar with the different kinds of medical professionals and the different trajectories into medicine. And a good proportion, I would say almost, if I'm not mistaken, 3/4 of the residents at Legacy were American citizens. So it never occurred to me to sort of reflect on where they had gone to medical school. I just assumed they were American doctors. I knew that there was about 1/4 of the residents that had gone to medical school outside of the country as non-citizens. But it took me a while, several months, to really piece together the fact that this hospital did not staff a single U.S. citizen medical doctor who had gone to allopathic medical school in its 3-year program. And so suddenly, you know, what I realized is that Legacy is what is known on the blogosphere as an IMG, International Medical Graduate, or DO, Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine, friendly residency program. And as that piece of the puzzle started to form, as early as the first day in the field, really, I had started to consider whether, you know, a comparison site might be in order, particularly because I wasn't seeing the kind of hierarchy I was expecting. Upon doing more research, I stumbled upon another internal medicine program in the same area, what I call Stonewood University Hospital. And that program, much to my surprise at the time, staffed almost exclusively U.S. MDs. These are U.S. citizens who went to allopathic medical schools. So suddenly this puzzle started to form in my mind, right? So why are these residency programs so segregated along the lines of U.S. MDs, non-U.S. MDs? What impact does this segregation have on the residents' training? How does it influence their mobility moving forward in the profession? And what do the residents make of this type of segregation? How do they make sense of it? And so eventually, as these pieces came together, I decided to set out to study these two programs comparatively over the course of 3 years. And that's how Doctor's Orders came together.
Yes, and I think this leads directly to maybe our next discussion on the topic of status separation. Originally, you were looking at an individual independently, a hospital called Legacy in your book, and not being able to see the hierarchy within, but instead looking at it as a social structure of medicine and doctors and the education they were receiving. And where they're ending up at for their residency, as well as employment afterwards. So what does status separation mean to you?
Yeah, status separation is kind of one of the key, I think, concepts that I hope comes through through this book, one of the key contributions. And simply put, it's the process by which a seemingly homogenous profession, a profession that seems to be all the same, at least within the same specialty, right? How that seemingly homogenous profession gets hierarchically differentiated by pedigree into various strata, according to the resident's social worth or status. And that process creates, you know, what is what I term horizontal stratification or differences in prestige among trainees in the same specialty. What's interesting or different about status separation is that it's a process that clearly benefits insiders in the profession, namely the elite, namely USMDs. There are other processes that have been sort of theorized about in the sociology of work and occupations. Labor market segmentation is a process that has been theorized about before, and it's a process by which the labor market is divided up into different segments, right? Into a primary segment where there are what could be construed as an elite, right? With individuals filling better paid jobs, positions that are considered sort of more advantageous to the worker, and a secondary labor market. And there's also been theorizing about stratification or segmentation within the primary labor market. But scholars who have written about labor market segmentation really view it as a process that benefits employers. It's a process that benefits capitalism, in effect, right? Because it's something that helps keep workers at odds with one another, and it prevents them from banding together and fighting for better work conditions. I see similarities in the process of status separation, but really this process isn't to benefit capitalism or to benefit employers. The process exists to benefit the elite themselves, to benefit insiders within the profession.
And how did you see this process benefiting the elites more than the non-elites? And in your case, it would be the U.S. medical doctors compared to those of non-U.S. medical doctors, particularly non-U.S. medical doctors, U.S. citizens going to the Caribbean, but also non-citizens of the U.S. attending schools elsewhere. How was status and power maintained by the elites?
Right. So really what I'm studying are two groups in this book. One group of American citizen medical doctors, the USMDs, and then a larger, more heterogeneous group, which I group together as or call, you know, collectively as non-USMDs. And as you pointed out, those non-USMDs include international medical graduates, both U.S. citizen and non-U.S. citizen international medical graduates, as well as doctors of osteopathic medicine. And so the question is, yes, how does status separation work such that USMDs are pushed to the top, if you will, of the status hierarchy, and non-USMDs are pushed towards the bottom? The term status separation, I actually got from a chemist colleague of mine who explained to me that separation in chemistry refers to the process by which a mixture gets reduced to its component parts, right? So we can think about that as happening through external forces like centrifuge, for example, or natural forces like gravity that separates oil and water, right? And in medicine, we assume, just as in many other fields, we assume that the force separating out the elite or the cream of the crop, if you will, is meritocracy, right? Hard work, intelligence, dedication. That those are the reasons why USMDs are at the top of the status hierarchy. What I find in my book is actually meritocracy had very little to do with the process of selecting the elite. And instead, I found that there were other social forces, namely four different social forces, in addition to eventual differences in merit that can explain some of the processes whereby USMDs form part of the elite within internal medicine. And the first process is broader class inequality. The second is sponsorship. The third are status beliefs, biases, and stigma. The fourth is structural inequality among training programs. And finally, yes, there are eventual differences in merit resulting from these these inequalities, which can contribute to status separation in medicine. And the reason why this benefits the insiders, the elites, is that status separation is widely taken for granted within medicine. And what I mean by that is that the sorting of medical graduates on the basis of their medical school of origin has become a kind of standard operating procedure. To the point where match statistics, even for post-residency positions, for specialty positions after residency fellowship, are reported along USMD, non-USMD lines. So status separation is the process that leads to these taken-for-granted outcomes. But just because they're taken for granted shouldn't be confused with being self-evident. And this is the piece that really benefits, I think, USMDs, that it's under the guise, under the illusion of unfettered meritocracy, that USMDs broadly differentiate themselves as being better than non-USMDs. When in fact, I find that the game of getting into medical school, getting into residency, getting into fellowship is structurally designed to favor USMDs, sometimes regardless of their performance. And so in other words, I find along the same lines as other scholars studying stratification, that meritocracy serves as a kind of well-worn cover for other social forces that are at play that can contribute to status separation, namely some of those forces I mentioned earlier, social reproduction, cumulative advantage, and sponsored mobility.
And much of this is extremely subtle, as most of sociology is. Maybe the people who have prestige, power, greater merit than the next don't even see the amount of wealth, the amount of power, prestige, the elite that they have.
That's exactly right. What I found was that consistently structural advantages or structural disadvantages were misrecognized as differences in individual merit, such that if, you know, someone from an upper socioeconomic status background who had many opportunities, many resources growing up, had the full support of the medical profession behind them in helping them achieve their goals, went to very well-resourced institutions that created opportunities for them, if that person reached, you know, the top, if they reached their residency of choice or their specialty of choice in fellowship, it was often assumed to be the product of their own individual hard work and dedication, as opposed to sort of recognition being placed on these structural factors that advantaged them.
What I think is important as well is to understand the structural forces that exist that have led to pass of a better medical training and better schools. So cultural capital and social capital, you bring that into your book as well to understand, to help readers and audience members understand that the beginning started far before medical school, correct?
That's right. Yeah, I took a real a life course approach to understanding trajectories into these two different programs. And so, you know, to understand why Legacy is staffed exclusively with non-USMDs and why Stonewood is staffed almost exclusively with USMDs, I really wanted to understand the social origins of the residents in both programs to sort of make sense of why they are where they ended up. And as you pointed out, Michael, you know, a lot of this starts in very early life. And what I found was that compared to international medical graduates, both U.S. citizen and non-U.S. citizen, as well as doctors of osteopathic medicine, USMDs simply just disproportionately came from much higher socioeconomic status backgrounds. And they had much more help from their families in playing the game, as they called it, of getting into medical school. Things as simple as having access to research opportunities early on, having parents that can ferry their kids to first aid lessons or cello classes, being able to afford to enroll in leadership forums as a teenager, right? They had all of these sort of opportunities for extracurricular activities, as well as support when, if and when they failed, right? So they had the resources to pay for tutors, to pay for elaborate assistance to take standardized tests, be it the SATs or the MCAT, right? And as I mentioned earlier, much of those advantages, however, were often misrecognized as pure differences in achievement, in individual level achievement, when in fact, they really just reflected broader class inequalities. What I also observed is that in addition to much stronger support and resources from families growing up from early social origins, once they got into medical school, and this was a key difference between USMDs and non-USMDs, the US grads were able to, in a sense, parlay, right, convert those early resources that they had into additional support from the profession itself. And this is what I call in the books, this is sort of one of the key findings of the book. There's a kind of social contract that I saw emerge between USMD trainees and the profession. It's an unspoken, although sometimes they spoke quite openly about this contract, it's socially agreed upon series of inputs and outputs or benefits of pursuing allopathic medical education in the U.S. And the idea is that once individuals put in the work and the money and defer gratification and you know, put in the dedication needed to gain admission to a U.S. allopathic medical school, the expectation and, in fact, the promise from the profession is that the profession will help ensure that those trainees will get to where they need to go, where they want to go professionally. And so if you look at the numbers nationwide, this wasn't just a pattern at Legacy and at Stonewood Hospital. Surprisingly nationwide, surprisingly few USMDs flunk out of medical school once they've matriculated. So over 95% of those that matriculate into allopathic medical school graduate within 5 years. By comparison, perhaps a profession more familiar to you and I, Michael, nearly one-fifth of matriculated PhD students drop out within 5 years, and almost 31% of them leave after 10 years. So here we're looking at fewer than 5% of medical students dropping out within 5 years. And about 94% of those 95% that graduate from medical school every year match to residency. And so, you know, in the end, for the vast majority of USMDs, it's not about whether they're going to match to residency, but it's really more about where. And what I found was the very clear evidence of the profession helping them get to where they wanted to go, whether it was offering extra tutoring, offering flexibility in scheduling so that if a student fell behind on a test or on an exam, that they were able to then reschedule that exam at a later date, whether it was just using, as you mentioned, social capital, right, and using connections and social networks to assist students, medical students in allopathic schools in the U.S. to get where they wanted to go. Really, they're getting all of this support from the profession that notably a lot of the U.S. international medical graduates, DOs, and certainly international medical graduates are not getting.
Particularly in certain specializations, having to go into general practice for residency. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. So we see great patterns of very stark patterns of segregation across specialties, whereby certain fields like family medicine, internal medicine are disproportionately filled by non-US MDs. Other fields, one that comes to mind is ear, nose, and throat medicine. If memory serves, the typical number is about 90% of positions in that specialty are filled by US MDs.
Excellent. And there was one reference that you put in your book about one of the residents who used the metaphor of the U.S. Navy SEAL versus the National Guard to sort of distinguish the separation between Legacy and Stonewood. Could you talk a little bit more about what she meant when she said the U.S. Navy SEAL and the National Guard?
Yeah, this was one of those moments in fieldwork where I knew the minute she said that this would somehow figure somewhere in the findings. The quote was just so powerful and really quite evocative of the kind of status hierarchies that I was studying, the status hierarchies between USMDs who train in university hospitals and non-USMDs who train in community hospitals. And so, you know, it wasn't just this resident. There was a conversation among the residents. This came out in a focus group where Stonewood residents really understood there to be two kinds of internal medicine residents, the kind of USMD kind of Navy SEALs, if you will, like them, like themselves, that trained at places like Stonewood, that form a kind of special breed of warrior, if you will, right? They're training in tertiary hospitals. They're preparing to handle some of the most complicated patients and situations. They're really viewing themselves as this special breed. And then on the other hand, a kind of reserve army of non-USMD National Guard forces that are training in smaller community hospitals to, you know, take on simpler roles in the profession, to treat bread and butter kind of cases in medicine. And of course, you know, she was referring to these kinds of differences between, you know, what are putative equals, right? These two types of residency programs, but, you know, are both in the business of training internists, right? So we're not comparing surgeons to pediatricians. We're comparing internal medicine residents to internal medicine residents. Yes. So there's horizontal stratification within internal medicine training. But of course, as I go on to find, we also find evidence of vertical hierarchies after graduation, where USMDs go on to disproportionately specialize and take on more specialized roles in the profession, whereas non-USMDs tend to remain generalists. And so that quote really kind of beautifully captured in a way the very phenomenon that I'm trying to understand.
And then what are some of the larger implications of the social separation between USMDs and non-USMDs as to much larger categories as we get into the details of whether they are citizens in non-USMD programs or non-citizens coming to the States in a variety of ways to practice medicine and to learn medicine? But what are some larger implications beyond medicine that this study could have for other professions?
Yeah, you know, I think this is, you know, very much a case study for broader patterns happening in other professional fields. Medicine is by far hardly the only example that we have where of a profession where status distinctions are drawn according to educational pedigree among putative equals, right? Among individuals studying to become the same thing effectively. So there is a number of studies of the legal profession that finds that effectively a kind of underclass of attorneys has been proliferating under a pretext of meritocracy, a very similar pretext that we find in medicine, when in fact a lot of the same kinds of processes of cumulative advantage, class inequality, and misrecognized privilege are undergirding some of those processes. In fact, the case of the legal profession is a little bit more, I would say, extreme than medicine, because what we're finding is the true proletarianization of attorneys being paid by the hour to do sort of very menial tasks in a way that we haven't quite sort of gotten to that point in medicine. We're still seeing status hierarchies, but physicians are still able to practice as fully licensed physicians in the profession. Another example, again, is near and dear to our hearts, of course, is academia, right? And so we're seeing very similar patterns where there's an oversupply of very well-qualified PhDs training in different kinds of programs, of course. And so we see those horizontal hierarchies emerge. With the ever sort of expanding supply of contingent faculty positions, right? There's an ever smaller number of tenure track positions, the highly coveted sort of tenure track positions, and the expansion of contingent faculty, which effectively create those vertical hierarchies that I write about in the book. And I note that much like in medicine, the elite in academia wouldn't exist were it not for the contingent faculty that are doing a lot of the teaching, right? That then frees up time for tenure track faculty to do research. Similarly, in medicine, you know, if it were not for these international and osteopathic medical graduates filling positions in underserved areas, in places, geographic areas that USMDs don't want to practice, and in fields of medicine that USMDs don't want to fill, if it weren't for those non-USMDs, then we would not have a USMD elite in the same way that we do now, that's then able to fill these more prestigious positions in the profession. And so there's a real parallel there with the academy. And of course, there's a parallel with, within the horizontal hierarchies between PhDs, right, where top tier graduates are coming from highly, well-resourced programs that have a lot of status behind them, a long history of status behind them, and simply have access to more resources during training, which then can make those graduates more competitive on the job market than those trainees that are studying in less well-resourced, maybe less well-known programs. So we see quite a few parallels, I think, in other professions. And I'm hopeful that the book will have, you know, an impact and have be able to speak to some of those processes beyond medicine.
And now I want to talk about the afterword that you so graciously shared with me with a change made to this testing process and changing from a score to a pass or fail. What implications do you think this change, this modification in one of the major tests taken by medical doctors or aspiring medical doctors might have on the practice and may have on residency placement?
Yeah, this was a massive change that happened while the book was in production. And so, you know, I was really fortunate to be able to put together this afterword before the book went to press. But yeah, effectively, you know, Michael, I spend much of the book really pushing back against this illusion of meritocracy in medicine, that the reason why we have this status separation may in part be due to merit, but is certainly not the whole story. And the part that may be due to merit is tied to this licensing exam. And so the United States Medical Licensing Exam, step one, it's a three-step exam. That step one exam is one of the single most important determinants of who gets, of really what type of residency program an applicant can match to. And, you know, what I found was that for the most part, non-USMDs were not seriously considered. In fact, much of the applications from non-USMDs would be discarded without review from Stonewood University Hospital. But there were a handful of exceptions. Between 6 and 12 applicants every year were considered from the pool of non-USMDs. And really, there were two things that would help them escape the chopping block, if you will. The first was scoring astronomically high on the USMLE. And by astronomically high, I mean two standard deviations above the national mean. So scoring a 270 is, I believe, in the 99th percentile, and it's you know, really going above and beyond what the average USMD candidate would do. And so really sort of setting an applicant apart. The other piece of it is goes back to what you mentioned earlier, and that was social networks. So if an applicant had scored in the 99th percentile on this exam and came with the endorsement of a known faculty member, someone who was known to the Stonewood program, is saying that this person was better than any American graduate that they had ever seen, then that might lead them to consider this person potentially for an interview at Stonewood University Hospital. So to bring this back to the change that happened last week or the week before to step one, one of my concerns is that making step one pass fail could potentially restrict that very small but existent window or pathway nonetheless to competitive residencies for non-USMDs. And what it might do is effectively, by reducing the two aspects that might get someone an interview, scoring astronomically high on step one and having social networks, it might then place more emphasis on those informal resources like social networks for getting non-USMDs in the door at certain competitive programs, which might further restrict, opportunities for non-USMDs and might eventually exacerbate segregation in the profession. Now, a lot of program directors and pundits within medicine have remarked in the weeks after the decision was announced that in all likelihood, what's going to happen is that step one is just going to get replaced by step two. Step two, the clinical knowledge portion of step two is the more clinically relevant cousin, if you will, of step one. Step one focuses mostly on basic sciences. So it remains to be seen whether that other test really becomes the most important factor now, if it replaces step one as being the most important factor for determining who gets into residency. Currently, not all residency programs require step two before applying to residency, so that may very well change. I think one of the main concerns about this new introduction of a pass-fail step one I worry that it won't necessarily change. Even if we get rid of step one, we replace it with step two, It's not going to necessarily ameliorate things for non-USMDs. Things might stay status quo or they might worsen, depending on what the implications are for what might be helpful for getting non-USMDs, a foot in the door at some of these competitive programs.
You know, I'm part of the Society for the Study of Social Problems, and our upcoming conference is about small wins. And I try to be optimistic as a sociologist, but it's difficult to be an optimist when seeing the underlying structural forces that create oppression in society. So, looking at that, my response to your email was very pessimistic.
Yeah, you know, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, and I also worry that that's a bit of an occupational hazard as a sociologist. We're painfully aware of the enduring social structures that lend durability to inequality. I do think that change is possible, but I think that in order to affect change in a way that's most likely to actually work in the long run is to target social structures. And those are difficult to target, particularly when those social structures are not rules or policies, because you'll note that I make the case, this is part of the puzzle of studying these two programs, that this segregation nationwide across programs, there's no policy that says that any hospital has to prioritize USMDs or even American citizens for that matter. And so in some ways, if there was a policy, it's in some ways straightforward to change it. What we're really talking about here is changing social norms and social beliefs. Status beliefs within the profession. And that's very difficult to do because it would come at the expense potentially of USMD dominance, right? I think, if we're continuing to rely on, as we do and as we have since the 1950s, international medical graduates and osteopathic medical graduates, I think that as a nation, we ought to, give them the opportunity to compete alongside USMDs for access to, to all kinds of residency positions. And I think that would be in the best interest of the healthcare system, right? Which in some ways has fallen by the wayside, I think, in conversations about how to allocate residency positions. Do we want the best people qualified, no matter where they're trained? Do we want the best people filling, much needed residency positions? Or do we want to continue prioritizing USMDs? And there are plenty of good reasons that respondents gave me for wanting to do that, including, wanting to protect the nation's own trainees, wanting to give back to Medicare, which funds residency training, all of which are good, good reasons for prioritizing USMDs. My concern is that prioritization happens informally. Again, no policies or procedures that require programs to give priority explicitly to USMDs. And so what ends up happening is that if those USMDs end up in the top positions, it gets assumed that it's because they're actually the best trainees and they've worked harder and have been more dedicated than non-USMDs, when in fact, it is probably more a reflection of status biases and status beliefs within the profession. I think change is possible. I think we would have to change social norms within medicine, or at the very least, make some of those norms more transparent and perhaps more formalized so that the rules of the game are clear to everybody, in a way that doesn't lead non-USMDs to blame themselves or for USMDs to blame non-USMDs. For being less motivated, less intelligent, less hardworking when they're not able to access those top positions in the profession.
And to create an equal playing field, or at least a more equal playing field for all to advance in their profession, because scores alone and going to a USMD and non-USMD is not enough to verify the quality of doctor that is going through these programs.
That's right. And, if we compare scores between non-USMDs and USMDs, what we find is that, at least in internal medicine, international medical graduates score just as highly as USMDs score on their step one exam back when it was a 3-digit score. Actually, if you parse that further, Non-U.S. citizen international medical graduates outscore U.S. citizens of all stripes, be they international medical graduates, USMDs, or DOs. And so from a pure score perspective, right, we're not seeing massive differences. Also, when we look at quality of care, right, so if we just compare the quality of care offered between USMDs and non-USMDs, studies dating back to the 1970s have consistently found either equal quality of care being offered by non-USMDs compared to USMDs, or in a recent study that came out of Harvard a few years ago, higher quality of care being proffered by international medical graduates as opposed to USMDs, right? So so again, it brings us back to pressing questions, in my opinion, about what the healthcare system needs and whether the profession is catering to the public's needs by filling positions with the most qualified individuals, or whether it's catering to its own needs in a way that, you know, that is really designed to reward USMDs in the most maximal way possible.
And potentially just reproducing the social structure through passing the torch down to the next generation of individuals who are already part of the good old boy club.
Exactly. Exactly. But in some ways it's more insidious, right? Because the process isn't transparently about sponsorship. The process is supposed to be about meritocracy. And as a result, it gets legitimated and gets perpetuated in a way that I think is perhaps even more disconcerting than, you know, back in the 1950s, Oswald Hall wrote about, you know, very formal types of sponsorship in the profession, whereby, you know, specialists were tapped at an early age and were sort of sponsored into the profession by specialists in certain hospitals. That was kind of the way things were. The advent of the MATCH program tried to do away with some of those formal sponsorship arrangements and tried to level the playing field. So now what we have is an unlevel playing field, that is being disguised, if you will, as a level playing field.
Yes. So where does this take you next? That's the big question always, right?
Right. My next work is going to actually stem from a puzzling finding from this current book. For all that USMDs are high status and have access to, you know, the most elite positions within medicine and the most well remunerated positions within medicine, they were also the most unhappy of all the residents that I spoke to. The disillusionment at Stonewood was palpable. A lot of the residents spoke of a so-called million-dollar mistake associated with going to medical school. A lot of them would not advise their peers to do it all over again. And so that left me puzzled, right? These are the highest status people in the profession. They seem to have it all, and they're the most unhappy. And so what is going on? And, you know, burnout, of course, within medicine is a massive problem. Burnout rates among trainees in particular have reached between 50 and 60%. 50 and 60% of trainees in medicine report feeling burnt out. And so there's this broader puzzle, to me anyway, about what is it about the medical profession that is causing so many physicians to get sick? Could it be related to some of the expectations inherent to the social contract that I've, you know, discovered through this process of research? What is it about medical education in particular that might be unwittingly leading to training a burnt out workforce? What are some of the professional norms, unspoken and spoken, about what it means to be a good doctor that could be contributing to some of these broader outcomes that have been well documented within medicine? And so in my next project, I'm really hoping to bring, again, a very sociological lens to bear on a problem that's all the rage right now in medicine, the burnout problem, but really to look at it from a completely different perspective, I think, than what it's currently being looked at. Physicians are very adept at looking at medical problems, health problems from a highly individual lens, right? That's in some ways how they're trained to think. And that's important, right? I think it is important to consider the individual determinants of burnout and how we might administer individual level solutions to those problems. As a sociologist, of course, I'm interested in the interplay between structure and agency. And so what I hope to do is bring a sociological lens to bear bringing the tools and methods of medical sociology, exploring massive macro changes that have been occurring in the profession, like the introduction of the EHR, like changes to professional autonomy that have all been theorized about in medical sociology, but then bringing them to bear on individual provider well-being, which hasn't yet been done in medical sociology. And so the next project is hopefully going to be another ethnography, where I spend time observing trainees at all levels of, at all different phases of the medical training life course, starting with pre-meds, all the way up to fully trained attending physicians, to really critically look at what it is about medical education, professional norms, and a hidden curriculum within medicine that could be contributing to some of these burnout outcomes.
And that'll be interesting to bring in the understand more how the social contract while in medical school brings everybody up and keeps everybody into in the system until they are placed in the job, which in which case they have a high burnout rate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of my respondents described the social contract as a double-edged sword, right? On the one hand, they knew that once they got into medical school, these were their words, not mine. You know, they had made it, right? That they were virtually guaranteed a career, virtually guaranteed a residency position, and it was all downhill from there, in their words. On the other hand, some respondents described the kind of guarantees of a career in medicine as a runaway train associated with a runaway freight train associated with the social contract, such that once they get into medical school, you know, there's no turning back. There's a huge investment in terms of debt. There's a huge investment in terms of deferred gratification for, you know, what could be a decade or more. And also a huge investment in terms of the support and respect and expectations from peers and family members, right? To go into medical school, there's huge expectations from one's community associated with that, making it, you know, a career where there's no turning back. It's very difficult to imagine a career outside of medicine. Some people do, and increasing numbers of folks are leaving medicine at an alarming rate, considering how many physicians were lacking in the country. But I want to sort of tie that concept of the social contract and its benefits and pitfalls to better understanding some of these health outcomes happening among the medical profession. To help better understand what really amounts to a mental health crisis in medicine right now.
Yes, and that mental health crisis in medicine, I think, in mental health in and of itself, the mental health crisis that exists in the profession of counseling as well. There's so many different professions to study in this way, particularly, and I find it fascinating, and I look forward to reading your publication learning about your research as you dig into this deeper through articles and other publications that this project might turn into.
Yeah, thank you. The goal is to write a second book. So yes. Hopefully we could do this again in a couple of years once the next book comes out.
I look forward to that. And please, once you get a contract with a publisher, please send me an email.
Sure. Yeah, I would be happy to.
Excellent. Well, this has been another episode of New Books in Sociology. Today I had guest Dr. Tanya Jenkins on the show. Thank you again for joining, Dr. Jenkins.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a complete pleasure.